Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries, produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I have an exciting prospect ahead of me. It's going to be the first time that we talk to a writer, in this case, Rachel Kushner, about work that she did before she was officially published in book form. A collection of pieces called The Strange Case of Rachel Kay has been published by New Directions. They were published in literary magazines?
Yeah, they were. It's a long time ago now, but one of them was in Soft Targets, which I wasn't involved in at the time. It was the first issue, very small, but kind of densely interesting literary journal. Had a short life, and then the second issue, I actually became one of the editors of it, but their first issue, one of the pieces was in, and then a Canadian journal called Descant, they were doing a Cuba-themed issue, and I knew that I wanted to write a novel that was set in and somehow dealt with the historical circumstances of Cuba in the 1950s, in the years right before the revolution. But I somehow took the prospect of writing something vaguely Cuba-related and sending it to them to see if maybe they would publish it as a helpful challenge or a generative challenge.
That novel became Telex from Cuba. Well, the first piece in this book is called The Great Exception. And it's written in the style of, I don't know what to say, a history book for children, a history book for people who don't know history. How did you imagine it? It's so charming. Let's hear the first couple of paragraphs. This is Rachel Kushner reading from her piece, The Great Exception. It's an early, early, early work.
"I don't care that the Earth's shadow eclipses the moon," said the Admiral. "I have seen terrific irregularity with mine own eyes and have been forced to the sensible conclusion that this earth is not round, as some wrongly insist, but the shape of a pear or violin." 1,000 years before the Admiral made his daring proclamation and charted his course on this violin-shaped earth, people thought it was flat like a discus. Until the Greek cartographer spoke out, claiming it was round like an orange. He'd drawn standard aesthetic divisions on his planisphere, a flattened version of his round earth. The first set of lines he called latitude, and the second set, trickier than the first, longitude. But his finest moment, his greatest act of self-control, had been to leave parts of his map blank. The cartographer was later forgotten, his maps lost like dreams that are lost upon waking, lingering only as faint, unglimpsable residues. Seafarers, with no reliable guide by which to brave the open ocean, paddled and were wind-scooted along in landlocked, salted waters. For navigation, they dead-reckoned and used wind roses, radiating lines of 16 focal points, ornate foliations that indicated air currents but varied according to the size and dimensions of the map, so that no two maps, even of one place, were ever alike. The cartographer was eventually remembered, but by then the forgetting had been sustained so long that no one could read Greek. The epic, after the cartographer's planisphere rained, and before it rained again, forgotten and then discovered but unreadable, was known as the Great Interruption. It lasted 1,000 years.
I love that tone of authority that comes, the Great Interruption that lasted 1,000 years. Let's be precise here. And it feels as if once upon a time, this book, which would be Telex from Cuba, would begin in the mists, in this imaginary cartography, imaginary history, and then become specified. Am I right in thinking that that was the original concept, something like Ramon Roussel making up a non-existent and imaginary history, a history as dream?
Yes and no. I wouldn't claim that I was that organized in terms of sort of planning out or prognosticating, which is really what a plan is if you're a fiction writer, what the novel was going to be from a beginning like the one I just read. I think I was beginning where I could and where I wanted to. And I had read this book by Daniel Boorstin called The Discoverers. He's sort of one of the great positivistic historians of Western civilization, I guess you could call it. Although at the time, I don't know if I would have described it thusly. It's just a book I found in a library and picked up one day and started reading. And I think that my response to it was this tone that you call both childlike and authoritative, or addressed to children and authoritative, because, you know, I oversimplify radically. Longitude, you know, was, it took them a long, long time to figure out longitude. But the Discoverers approaches the conquest of the New World. I don't want to oversimplify it, but in a way, it approaches it as though it is both inevitable and part of a general current of progress, and all progress is good, and progress that is scientific is right. And there's a discarding of superstition, which is associated with those original inhabitants of these lands, and et cetera. So there was something about that book that generated for me the need to respond. And I was just thinking of Cuba as a place that manifests itself in the imagination of these Europeans, which is really when its recorded, you know, Occidental history begins. And so I thought it was as good a place to start as any other.
I'm talking to Rachel Kushner. She is the author of The Flamethrowers and Telex from Cuba, and recently a volume of the inspiration stories that led to Telex from Cuba has been published under the wonderful title The Strange Case of Rachel Kay. And you're having fun too. The dancer, Rachel Kay, appears historically, but she shares your name, and you give her a life that is a very witty one. She's wittily in control of circumstances she has absolutely no power over.
Oh, that's nicely put. Yeah, I guess so. I would agree with that. Should I explain a little about why she has a name like my own? I was reading, there's a really remarkable book about the sort of renaissance of Cuban cinema after the revolution there by a British film historian named Michael Channon. And I was reading it, and he makes mention of a film that the Cubans made in, I think, 71, early 70s, called The Strange Case of Rachel Kay, El Extraño Caso de Rachel Kay. It's not Raquel, it's Rachel, and it's Kay. And he says, that the film is about, I'm paraphrasing here, but quote unquote, a French variety dancer who was killed in an orgy with high-level political officials. And this was in the 1930s. I made it in Batista's era, the 50s. It was actually in Machado's era, but she came to somehow symbolize the high watermark of dictatorial decadence in Cuban society. But I think that almost nothing is known about this figure. She's sort of like a pure symbol that's there for use. So in a way, that's part of her maybe objectification, even as a call girl and dancer, is that she's kind of objectified in this historical use. I still have never seen the film that they made, but I was curious about this character and that her, if she's French, why is her last name K? And there's no period after K, so it's not short for anything. It's just this Kafkian spot or mark. I felt that it was a kind of sign. I mean, I'm not exactly superstitious, but when you are walking into the blankness as a writer, you must take cues, I think, from somewhere. So she was the kind of cue that I took.
And she has reinvented herself as something we know as a projection,
right,
a Marlene Dietrich kind of character.
Right. Right. You're thinking of the Blue Angel.
The Blue Angel, or someone singing "See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have," a kind of rowdy but totally controlled presence who, for instance, in Touch of Evil, it's Marlene Dietrich who looks at Orson Welles and says, "Your future is all used up."
Right. Yes. She also says, "Maybe you should lay off the candy," right? Something like that.
She is speaking, Rachel Kaye, to all of the people struggling for power, Fidel and his brother Raul, and that invention of a character who can order this disorder, this chaotic experience, is, I think, a really strong act for a novelist, because, you know, she probably doesn't exist, and yet she is the way of telling the story.
Right. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, it's characters sometimes do serve device-like capacities for writers, and when you have a feeling and a tone and a set of images that you know are pressing in and want to be expressed, you still need some modality by which to express them, unless you just want shadings and image without any narrative propulsion. And I was just thinking of, there's a book by Alejo Carpentier called Kingdom of This World. And one of the characters, I think, lives, you know, 350 or 400 years so that he can witness and have pass through him all of the different machinations of the Haitian Revolution and tell them to the reader. And this is something slightly different, and yet I don't claim to compare my writing to Carpentier. I think he's an absolute genius. But there's a way in which sometimes you need one character to facet themselves in such a manner that they can report on and be witness to historical events. And when you write about history, yes, you want to have occasion to report on what happened. With Cuba, the political history, it is quite Baroque, and the telling of it is also quite Baroque. If you look at the classic historians of Cuba from the West, have been like Hugh Thomas. He's a great British historian who wrote Cuba, The Pursuit of Freedom. And the details in that book concerning this era when there were multiple coups starting in 52, and then in 51 there was this radio personality who shot himself on air because of the corruption, and et cetera, et cetera. It's very tempting to want to have some witness to some of these events.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Rachel Kushner about her book, The Strange Case of Rachel Kay. We'll continue after this short break.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps, available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Rachel Kushner about her recently published book, The Strange Case of Rachel Kay, but it is a collection of early versions of her first novel, Telex from Cuba. Now, how did you feel about putting these things, making them available for display?
It was not something that would have occurred to me to do. Which isn't to say that I wanted them to be suppressed. There are plenty of things that I, you know, would suppress. But the editors of New Directions came to me, Barbara Epler and Michael Barron. It was really Michael Barron's idea to put together these pieces of writing that I had done and make them into a book. And at first, I didn't feel that there was any urgency because I wrote them so long ago that I wanted to take my time and think about it. But he was very persuasive, and I guess I'll out myself as being slightly passive, but I trusted to them that if they thought it was a good idea, maybe somebody else would think so too. And Barbara Epler is someone to me who is a very important figure, and we need her. I mean, she has contributed in incredible, manifold ways to making contemporary literature vital, especially literature and translation. And I am, you know, I feel like I am a student of the prose that she has made available in English. And if they thought that they wanted to publish it, I was going to let them do it.
The three pieces gathered in The Strange Case of Rachel Kay are hypotheses about Telex from Cuba. The possibilities don't get dropped from the novel. In fact, there is a scene in the first piece where a version of Columbus is telling a version of Queen Isabella
right.
that the world is round like her breast. And he's ogling her and eyeing her, and it's a comic scene of seduction, counter-seduction, colonialism, sexism. It's kind of an amazing hypothesis about the idea of owning the new world
right.
the way a conqueror owns a woman, a queen.
Sure. I mean, you know, I'm probably not the only person who has thought about the comparison between those two forms of conquest. I think I was rereading a lot of Richard Howard's translations of Baudelaire when I was working on that, thinking about that. There's some relationship for me there to, like, you know, Baudelaire's invitation to a voyage is, it's less whimsical probably, but it probably planted the seed in my mind that it's okay to look at the more louche conditions of sort of, you know, colonial exploits and what the traveler is.
It's very interesting that you say that, because the Richard Howard translation of the Baudelaire is now regarded as somewhat comical because it is so decadent.
It's completely, it's crazy in places.
And
yeah.
yet it is a beautiful invention of decadent diction in a language that's not French.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, I actually brought it with me, but there's a passage where he says, let's burn our brains out to find the new. I think that's in Travelers. And that's not what Baudelaire says in the French, but I'm willing to take it. As long as I have other translations of Fleur du Mal, I'm fine with Richard Howard's. It's pretty spectacular.
Oh, well, that's fascinating, too. Would you say that as long as there are other histories of Cuba, that Telex from Cuba stands in its place but can't stand alone, has to be part of the broad spectrum of writing about that place?
No.
Tell
no.
me.
It's the only book that's ever been written about the role the Americans played, very significant role in the Revolution, just in being guests that overstayed their welcome, that, you know, forged a preferential treatment relationship with the government of Cuba, did not have to abide by any labor laws, et cetera, and just the geographical circumstances that Raul and Fidel Castro grew up on their father, Angel Castro's farm, which was 8 kilometers from this American colony. There's no other book that tells the story of that. So if there were other books, I would say sure, but maybe I'm not looking at your question in the way I should.
I mean, there's an inventiveness here. My favorite character in the book is called Panda. Called Panda because she has a birthmark over her eye that makes her look like a panda. But all of her brothers and sisters are called by their nicknames instead of their own names. And there's a sense that the book is inventing the names for things as it goes along. Panda likes to wear her nightgown out on the street. She is so individual and so much not a member of her family that she becomes a kind of temporary resident of a beautiful railway car.
Oh, right. Yeah, the Pullman car.
Yes, it's so velvety and golden. And she is its denizen. That sense that the level of invention in the book needs to be placed aside every other kind of invention, every fact, every newspaper, that the book is a distillation of different kinds of ways of thinking about the Americans in Cuba.
I think that's probably true. It is. I think of it that way myself, as a distillation, because I know what was distilled down. And yet, that Pullman car is real, and it belonged to the president of Cuba's United Fruit Company operation. And I interviewed his son, and he told me all about Daddy's Pullman car. And my mother, who lived in Cuba as a child, had been in that Pullman car. Other people had been in it and told me about it. Things take on a mythical significance in their own time and retroactively in new forms and ways. But to put the Pullman car in the novel is in a way to honor the actual historical record. And then this family with the children, of course, I invented them and wrote them. I wanted to be free to do it my way. I'm not a historian. I don't write nonfiction. But I do see fiction as being somehow in service to a kind of truth. Even if that's a cliche, I promote it in a sense in terms of wanting to not be egregious with a history that matters somehow a great deal. There are real stakes to it. And that family was meant to be something like the families that came from southern Louisiana to work in the tropics. They would be transferred from place to place, not necessarily just Cuba, whatever, Bolivia, Paraguay, moving around as labor bosses and overseers who knew how to handle workers because of where they come from in a kind of post-slavery plantation culture of Louisiana. So I was thinking about all of this as I constructed. But then there's a moment where there has to be life and freedom, and the girl gets the name Panda because that's fun for me.
Well, she was a beautiful figure, and I identified her with you as needing solitude to get away and write, to wear whatever she pleased, to look however she wanted to look. She was the figure, it seemed to me, of delighted escape.
Oh, I like that.
It was very moving to me to meet her. And in some ways, she explained you to me because I see you as a writer who is always creating modes of escape from dense authoritarian structures, including the structure of the novel, that there has to be freedom in life found, even in subject matter, which is all about restraint and control. And I believe you're writing about prisons now.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's interesting. I agree with you. I mean, it's nice to hear you say that. She goes into the Pullman car. So there's a kind of misuse there, and it's not going anywhere. It's a traveling car. But yes, I guess I would agree. I mean, the novel as a structure is never really a given. It has to have multiple possibilities. And I think that the way that I look at it as something that can incorporate discontinuity, it seems to have a future.
There's a real pleasure in experiencing the freedom of the novelist there, that the novelist can do this because it was there to be done and to move on from it. I would say in The Flamethrowers, you take that possibility to a kind of festival of invention.
Nice. Yeah, I guess, I mean, I would say that with The Flamethrowers, I was more self-authorized to do that, to do exactly what I wanted and to bring a lot more of my sense of humor into my prose and into creating dialogue and moving people around. And I was just starting to experiment with that maybe in the first novel.
I've been talking with Rachel Kushner, and we've been talking about The Strange Case of Rachel Kay, published by New Directions. And I found it fascinating, charming, tantalizing, and very enjoyable to read. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Charles Baxter is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.